At a fuel stop on Front Street, a truck driver pumps gas into a bright red semi.
My name is Joshua, and I've been driving truck almost now 4 years.
Trucking is a tough job, but Joshua loves doing it.
So far, I like it. No regrets.
He's in his late 20s, and he's just getting his start. Right at this moment, when self-driving cars are becoming a thing, some people think automation will take over the trucking industry, but Joshua isn't too worried.
Challenges there every day in life, but still, we have to step up and do what we're going to do. I don't know.
In fact, he's in it for the long haul.
I plan to retire as a truck driver.
For Joshua, truck driving is an art, from interacting with a customer when you make a delivery to just backing up the vehicle. It's a task he believes a computer would have a hard time doing.
Even if they have an automatic truck, I'm not sure if they'll be able to maneuver backing up. I don't know. But, you know, in technology, everything is possible.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we are talking about the future of work. Automation is making some jobs obsolete in everything from manufacturing to farming to grocery shopping. A study just came out showing that most shoppers prefer interacting with a barcode to a human being, which doesn't bode well if you're hoping for a backlash against the trend. In fact, researchers say half of today's work activities could be automated by the year 2055. So how's that going to work? I mean, how will people who used to do things like pumping gas, depositing checks, and driving tractors make a living? Call 816-235-2888 if you work a job that could disappear in the foreseeable future because of technology. Are you making a plan B, retraining for some other field, just hoping for the best? 816-235-2888. Let's start our conversation with Joshua Montgomery. He's an entrepreneur whose company makes smart houses, houses that can kind of take care of themselves and their inhabitants. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
So clearly, you aren't in much of a position to argue against automation or artificial intelligence. I mean, you develop and promote it.
It's hard to argue against automation because it is the future. There's nothing that we can do really to stop it, you know, that we can mitigate the results or mitigate the impact of the technology, but it becomes very difficult to prevent it from becoming reality.
So when we've talked in the past, you have indicated that people in your field actually talk about this a lot.
Yeah, the folks in artificial intelligence, folks who are building new things, both in Silicon Valley and in the tech scene in Kansas City, actually spend a lot of time thinking about the impact of the technologies they're building.
So what do those conversations sound like?
Well, it becomes really obvious as you start working deeper inside these technology stacks and as your day-to-day job ceases to be, you know, what can we do today and begins to be imagining what we can do tomorrow, that many of the jobs around you are what they sometimes call ripe for disruption.
That sounds very euphemistic.
Yes, that there are new technologies that can be put into place to make old technologies obsolete. And for many technologists, that's a business opportunity. And we've had several major disruptions in the economy over the last couple decades, including local news. You know, the local newspaper is not what it once was, and that's as a result of technological disruption.
Yeah, I noticed that one. I mean, you know, I want to know how you see technology changing the workforce already. You mentioned local news, and we have seen shrinking newspapers, which translates to shrinking newsrooms. What else?
So a really good example is the self-checkout line at your local grocery store. Those are jobs that at one point in many grocery stores, and some still are, union jobs that were very well paid, where you might have an ongoing relationship with the checkout clerk at your local grocery store that really had a lot of high-touch human interaction. And in many cases, those have now been replaced by automated point-of-sale systems where you walk up and you check your own groceries out. Here in San Francisco, our friends at Amazon have deployed a new store that doesn't even have the checkout counter, that they put the entire store under very thick video surveillance. They put RFID tags and barcodes on all the products, and you just load them in your cart and walk out, and they check you out automatically. And so that's one, certainly one place where employment will change.
You know, I was recently on vacation in San Francisco, and I don't know if San Francisco is sort of on the cutting edge of this stuff. I did walk past a coffee shop that was not staffed with baristas, and you know, it was an automated coffee shop.
Yeah, they have an automated French bread machine here in the Valley where you can walk up to it and get freshly baked French bread.
Freshly baked by whom?
Baked by a machine. So
that's
you walk
I
up
feared.
And it bakes it fresh and it dispenses it, you know, based on quarters or a credit card. So and you know, this is a very odd place to be. I recall taking a meeting in Redwood City, talking to a potential investor, and you know, telling him that this was the place of the future. And as I did that, an automated delivery robot rolled by on the sidewalk behind me, delivering somebody's lunch for them.
In places beyond San Francisco and looking past retail, because I think that's something that all of us have to some degree or another already witnessed. Like, and a lot, you know, I remember a time when it was pretty standard to have a full serve option at the gas station, and now it is very standard not to have that. We all just pump our own gas. So these are things that we all notice in our day-to-day life. Where is this heading in ways that, you know, maybe we don't notice, that aren't observable in day-to-day life?
Well, call centers are a good example. I know that call center assistants, as they stand today, are very frustrating for users and for customers. However, you know, in the future, those will get better and better and better until at some point you'll cease to be able to tell whether or not you're talking to a computer system or whether you're talking to Jenny, your helpful call center agent. That's certainly one place. Self-driving cars and self-driving trucks, as you mentioned, are already on the streets. There's certainly a lot of advantages, but as we found out this week, where there was a fatality in Tempe, Arizona, where a self-driving car killed a pedestrian, there are certainly costs associated with deploying these technologies as well.
What about, we've talked about a lot of blue-collar industries. Do you see white-collar jobs being equally affected?
Some jobs have some built-in barriers to entry. For example, the legal profession, you know, there's a variety of certifications, and you have to be a member of the bar. The same for physicians and others, where I think that the nature of their work will change. And in some cases, it already is, you know, the using machine learning algorithms and image recognition algorithms to improve diagnoses for radiologists, for example, spotting cancer in slides. And in other cases, I think that there is a lot of room for automation. So maybe not the attorney, but maybe his assistant becomes more and more digital. Interestingly, you know, if you look at the employment numbers for the country, it hasn't seemed to impact overall employment. And so it could be that this is one of those cases where everybody's shouting that the house is on fire and there really isn't a fire. Maybe it's similar to what happened in agriculture over the last century, where farms became more and more automated and people who used to live on farms migrated to the cities. Those folks still have jobs. They're just very different from what they were 100 years ago.
Are there, you said there's no point talking against automation or whatever, but I mean, are there aspects of this that could be within our control as consumers if we just plain don't like it? Like, let's just imagine, it seems unlikely, but let's just imagine some kind of consumer revolt against online shopping. Just people really got to missing that human interaction and they say, like, enough, you know? Would that be enough to turn the tide, or is this sort of beyond consumer control?
Well, I think in many ways it's being driven by consumers. If you look at the history of Walmart down in Bentonville, for example, you know, Sam got started with Ben Franklin stores. So these were local five and dime type stores where a gentleman stood behind the counter and helped you to pick out your purchases, whether it was flour or sewing needles or cloth. And the Walton family really discovered that they could get into discount retailing, where they built these large warehouse style stores and consumers could come in and self-service. And the the pivot from full service retail to discount retail really, in many ways, destroyed independent retailers, both in the United States and increasingly globally. You know, we have another shift coming, and it's very interesting for me as an entrepreneur to look at Walmart as the underdog. But online, Walmart is the underdog. Amazon is eating their lunch. And, you know, the reason is because it's super convenient to get on Amazon Prime or Amazon Fresh, order your groceries. And here in the Valley, where we are kind of on the tip of the spear, in many cases, those groceries just show up in less than an hour. They're less expensive than they would be if I drove to a store. And of course, I save the 30 to 45 minutes it would have taken me to drive to the store and pick up my own goods.
And if we're talking about employment and those trends and how this all relates, I mean, if people are trying to lead busy lives and hang on to jobs that they have that are asking a lot of them, it's hard to fault them for wanting to save 45 minutes.
Yeah, the consumer is always right. And those 45 minutes have a cost, both in fuel and in transportation for your car. And if there's a provider out there that can provide something that's more convenient and less expensive, consumers have a tendency to vote with their wallets. And automation makes things, in many cases, more convenient, less expensive. It's why automated Uber systems and automated systems like Waymo and Lyft, it's why they're so excited, because the driver is one of the biggest expenses in that ride. And if they can eliminate the driver, they can make it less expensive, which means more people will use it.
So for a techie like yourself, I mean, what is the most optimistic vision imaginable to you for the next generation when it comes to the future of work?
So I'm actually very excited about it, because if people aren't stocking shelves in a grocery store, if people aren't moving things around a warehouse, it frees them up to do things that are much more creative and much more fulfilling. And so, you know, as automation begins to do many of the jobs that most of us don't want to do. I mean, long-haul trucking is a job, but, you know, if you talk to many truckers who've had long careers, it's not the best job from the standpoint of quality of life. You know, being able to spend your time being creative, starting new businesses, creating new products, creating art, doing things that have value, that are high touch, I think will be much more fulfilling.
I just want to say, I mean, Karl Marx made this exact argument that not having to produce widgets or whatever frees people up to pursue fulfillment. But there is this problem of how people will have dollars.
There is, but, you know, people have a tendency to make this work. You know, there's certainly a lot of people in the Valley that feel that, you know, the amount of wealth that's being generated really should be shared by the society in general. And we do that through the tax base and are able to provide people with good educations and put them in positions to have careers where they spend more time being creative than they do, you know, implementing rote work. I think it's an opportunity for us to live in a land of plenty if we manage it appropriately.
Okay, well, so I did ask you what your most optimistic vision was, and it sounds like you are just by nature optimistic about this. But do you have a nightmare vision?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've had an increase in wealth, the disparity in wealth distribution in our nation over the last 30 years since the changes in the tax code that came in the 1980s during the Reagan administration that really have prevented have really not put in place the tools that we need to make sure that those in our society who might not own technology companies and those in our society who might not be landowners have the same opportunities as those who are. And so there's certainly a future where all of the wealth that's being generated by this technology flows to very few people and everybody else is left with issues of employment and with issues of wealth creation. And that's something that we need to look at very carefully. It's very important that we don't, if in my mind at least, that we don't live in a society where one man flies around in his own private 767 and another man sleeps on the street with no food. You know, there has to be mechanisms to make sure that everybody's able to participate in the wealth that automation is creating.
Call 816-235-2888 if automation might be affecting your job, even possibly replacing it. Are you making a plan B, retraining, hoping for the best? buying into the vision that technology could provide or railing against it? 816-235-2888. Vladimir Medenica is with us now. He is at the University of Chicago, and he just completed a study on how millennials see this issue. Hi, Vlad.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Doing well, thanks.
So the study looked at what exactly?
So Gen Forward is the name of the study, and it's a bi-monthly survey of millennials, which we define as adults between the ages of 18 and 34. What sets us apart from other surveys is that we pay special attention to how race and ethnicity shape the experiences and opinions of millennials, particularly as they relate to politics, but also across a range of areas, including the economy and technology. In our most recent survey, that's exactly what we focused on. We focused on millennial experiences with technology, both how they use them and how they think that technology will affect them, particularly around issues of labor and employment.
So it is interesting. I mean, we think of millennials as the technology embracing generation, but it seems like they don't necessarily see technology paving the way for a solid workplace.
I think that's right. I think that as the generation that's kind of grown up with technology as we know it and the advances in technology that we've seen, they are aware of the benefits but also struggle with the challenges of technology. So at the individual level, millennials have a concern that technology and especially advances in technology will decrease the number of jobs that they'll have access to in the future.
So what do you see as how millennials think we should be dealing with that?
Well, one of the things that we asked about is that we wanted to get an idea of what millennials think about the government's role on the issue is, particularly around the displacement of workers as we move forward. So to do this, we ran an experiment in our survey where we randomly asked about half of our respondents whether the government should have an obligation to take care of people whose jobs are displaced by robots and computers and technology more generally. And the remaining 50% of respondents were asked the same question, but with additional language around taxes. So they were asked whether the government has an obligation to take care of displaced workers, even if it means raising taxes substantially. So this allowed us to compare general support for a government program versus support that comes at a cost in the form of additional taxes, which, you know, most people don't like. But what we found is that overwhelmingly, around 70 to 80% of millennials across race and ethnicity believe that the government has an obligation to take care of displaced workers. And this is true even when the language on taxes is added to the question. Now, support drops a little bit, about 10 to 15 percentage points, so from, you know, maybe 80% down to about 65, 70%. But still, they exhibit a lot of support for such a program.
So I just want to, like, take a highlighter over something you just said, which is that millennials largely would like the government to have a role in helping people with their livelihoods as jobs are lost to automation.
That's right. And I think this speaks to a little bit what Josh just said about tax base and how we should have a tax base to help with the transition in labor from a human workforce to one that relies more heavily on automation, AI, algorithms, and so on and so forth. And we see quite a bit of support for that among millennials.
That is an idea that would have, I feel like that would have been seen as very radical to previous generations.
You know, I think that might be true. I'm not sure. But millennials, you have to remember, came of age during a sort of very difficult economic time. They're entering the labor market by and large around 2008, the height of the Great Recession. And so they're used to seeing this constriction in the availability of jobs and at best a stagnation, if not a real drop in wages across the country. Millennials, more than just about any other generation, are having difficulty, you know, doing things like buying a home. They're riddled with student debt. And I think that that puts them in a position where they are more attuned to these sorts of economic concerns.
Well, hang on with me, Vlad, because we're taking a short break. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Vladimir Medenica from the University of Chicago. We'll hear some local perspectives, including yours, in just a minute. 816-235-2888 is the number to call to weigh in on the future of work. on KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the future of work. We were inspired by the closing of two local manufacturing plants, Harley-Davidson in Kansas City, Missouri, and Procter & Gamble in Kansas City, Kansas. But this goes beyond manufacturing. It is hard to imagine a field that hasn't been affected in some way or another by technology, and studies project that half of our current work activities could be automated by the year 2055. So the question we're asking is what we're all going to do. We've been discussing that with Joshua Montgomery of the tech firm Mycroft, where they're developing smart homes, and Vladimir Medenica, a researcher at the University of Chicago. He's done a study on how millennials see the future of work. We're about to go to your calls, but I want to turn quickly to Ryan Weber, president of the KC Tech Council. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. When you see how this all plays out in Kansas City, do you see something that hasn't come up already?
Well, I think maybe it has, but I think it's important to note that education is important. You still need to go and get an education, but skills are what's really driving the future economy. And even recently, we saw that when Amazon was trying to select where they were going to put a second headquarters, and we were not a finalist. And I think in a lot of ways, that was because of perception of the lack of that skills-based economy in Kansas City.
When we say skills, are you talking about a particular kind of skill?
Yeah, I think in our world, I'm particularly talking about technology skills, those computer-based skills, you know, developers, engineers, those that actually have those key skills. But even in manufacturing, I mean, we talk about a word like advanced manufacturing. That is a computer job. You work at a computer terminal, you program robots, and it's very much a technology job inside of a manufacturing facility.
So on some level, I mean, if robots are going to take a lot of jobs or do a huge portion of a lot of jobs, then are jobs created like building and training robots? Is that kind of what you're saying?
I mean, in some ways, it's not going to take over everything immediately. It's probably scaring people how quickly some of this is happening, especially with self-driving cars. I mean, some people may realize we were just talking about that a couple of years ago, and now we're seeing them on the roads, and soon we may be seeing self-driving trucks. But there still is a human need, and those jobs are going to be very skills-based. They will not be education-based jobs. So you may have to go to a junior college. You may have to go to a vocational school. That's where you're going to find the training for the future of work.
You know, I've printed up this little list of the small number of jobs that studies have shown to be, you know, potentially 100% automatable versus 100% not automatable. And on the list of things that is apparently automatable, slaughterers and meat packers. And regionally, Kansas is home to some meat packing plants. Like, this is that serious, you know, for people. And I guess I'm wondering if there is a job with an equivalent level of training and education that you see opening up in this new economy.
I think we can fantasize what those are going to be if you look into the crystal ball. And you can look at almost a lot of different jobs and say they're 100% automatable. But that does not mean that humans will not be necessary.
Not astronomers and not athletes and not musical directors or composers, apparently.
Well, that makes me very happy about the future.
Well, let's get some of our callers in on this. We have a lot of people who want to weigh in. And I want to talk to Robert in Blue Springs. Hi, Robert.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good. How about you? Please let us know what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I'm a lawyer, and I primarily represent folks who apply for Social Security disability benefits. And already, folks who are on the lower skill level spectrum are at a tremendous disadvantage in this economy. And the reality is that there is a percentage of the population that will never, ever be able to do highly skilled work. Folks are struggling to maintain the skill levels they have already. And the reality of the situation is the only real social safety network we have left in this country is Social Security disability, which is exclusively funded by payroll taxes. Okay, and so the concept that an increased tax base may be able to care for everybody is, my perceptive, a little pie in the sky, in that we're going to have to shift the tax burden from the FICA tax, which practically everyone pays, to a general income tax, which in today's political economy seems to be going down and not up. And I don't necessarily have a good solution to this, But I do want to at least put the thought out there that it's not practical to think that everyone can become a computer scientist.
Yeah, let's thank you for that insight, yes. Robert. And Josh, you know, I realize that you are not a tax lawyer, but I am curious how you respond to what Robert says.
Oh, I feel very strongly that we should change the tax rate specifically for unearned income to be much, much, much higher than it is today. You know, back in the days of Eisenhower, you know, the prototypical Kansas Republican, the top tier tax rate was 90%. And when you look at, you know, especially in Silicon Valley and in other areas, if you look at people who are making billions of dollars a year and pay a lower tax rate than the secretary who works in their front office, that's both a travesty and a danger when it comes to the distribution of wealth within our society.
I want to talk to Chris in Idaho. Chris is a truck driver giving us a call. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you doing this morning?
Good. How about you?
Doing great.
You're driving through Idaho now?
No, I'm driving through Missouri right now.
That
I
makes...
just went through Kansas City.
That makes sense. I was wondering how you heard us in Idaho. Okay, tell us what you want to share.
I'm not too worried about automation. I am somebody you call a jack of all trades. I've worked in lumber mills, electrician, shipyards. Currently, I'm a truck driver. I've had my own business as a handyman. And I have seen the automation in large warehouses, in lumber, and so forth. But at the same time, I see it as customer service. As when I had my handyman business, I was always right there with the customer, talking to the customer, interacting with the customer. And I think there will always be a need for that customer service, for that personal touch that you will not be able to get from a robot, from automation. Same thing with truck driving. I love this job, and I am a customer service oriented person, so I can get into my shipper or my customer or whoever and be able to socialize with them, put a smile on their face, or they put a smile on my face. And I don't ever think you're going to get a robot or any kind of automation to do that. Sure, people want things quicker, which is grocery stores, maybe a restaurant, a retail outlet, Walmart or something, Amazon. But when it comes down to that personal touch of communication and everything, I think there will always be that customer service base there.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for sharing that, and safe driving.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You know, what I'm curious about with what Chris says, because I agree with him that people really appreciate that human touch, but sometimes they only appreciate it once it's lost in a certain industry. Like, I mean, you hear people bemoaning sort of a lost era of this, that, and the other when we remember how it used to be. But sometimes we notice that once our convenience or necessity has already eliminated that role and eliminated that way of doing things. Ryan, I want to start with you.
Artificial intelligence. I mean, unfortunately, it's coming and it's getting better every day. In fact, even this week, Sprint announced the use of additional artificial intelligence in their call centers. And Josh mentioned this too. It's not perfect today, but it will be very good very soon. And it may be better than that human experience that you mentioned.
Better in for some people, perhaps.
Correct.
Definitely not better for the truck driver we just heard from.
Yeah, maybe not. So this isn't going to be for every industry, every person. But I think specifically for the younger generation, they're going to appreciate and expect it more.
As consumers.
Correct.
But then as workers, Vlad, I mean, we're hearing about the younger generation specifically, how they see that as people who will need jobs.
Exactly, yeah. So there is a large concern about the availability of jobs more generally in the future. Majority of millennials, or at least a plurality of millennials, believe that advances in technology will lead to a decrease in the number of jobs in the U.S.
Does that vary across racial lines, across other kinds of identity lines, or is this like millennials are pretty much in lockstep on this view?
Well, it's interesting. We asked two different questions. One is at the individual level, whether or not millennials are worried about their own job prospects. And there you do see a bit of variation by race. White millennials are the least concerned about their own job prospects. But when we zoom out and we ask about the number of jobs in the U.S. more generally and the availability of those jobs, we see pretty great consistency there in terms of concern. A plurality of every racial group and a majority of African Americans believe that increases in technology will lead to a decrease in jobs.
Let's talk to Nancy with us from Drexel, Missouri. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm 79. As a girl, I was trained in business college to be a stenographer. And, of course, nobody used shorthand. When I was taking the class, we were told that the only place they use them is in the mines. It seems that in the mines, and they are very superstitious about having women in the mines. So if you were going to do stenography in a mine, you had to be male.
Nancy... I'm so sorry, but our connection is bad, and it's hard to make out what you're saying. I might try to get back to you in a moment, but Nancy, it sounds like, was trained as a stenographer, which I think most of us can deduce is not a widely available job right now. And I want to sort of piggyback on that idea with another sort of, you know, what you might see as an old-timey trade, embroidery, because we have a tweet from Cheryl who says, my entire job is computer/robot. I'm an embroidery shop that uses the computer to generate digital files that the machine stitches. Age-old craft moved into this century. I totally rely on me for creating the art and the machine to make it in thread. You know, Josh, I want you to comment on this relationship between the human and the technology.
Yeah, I think that's where the future of work really lies, is working with, and I do the same. You know, we built a smart speaker. I don't have the personal skills to sculpt a clay model and create a reverse mold so that we can do the plastic injection. I rely on computer-aided design software and 3D printing to make those enclosures. And so the automation and the technology has really empowered me to build a lot of things I couldn't have before, because the AI and the tech takes the place of, you know, a master craftsman in many ways.
I want to talk to Kate, who is joining us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Gina. My comment is, well, I have a few comments. One, I guess, refers to Joshua's description of his sort of most optimistic view and his nightmare vision of what might happen with kind of continuing automation of many of the things that, you know, we encounter in the work world or some of the careers, I guess, that we traditionally prepare for. And I'm just thinking that the nightmare vision is much more supported by all of the evidence. And so I'm really concerned about that. I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of evidence in our history to support sort of the optimistic vision. I come from Austin, Minnesota, which is the home of Hormel and the, you know, the
wait, I'm sorry, it's the home of what?
Hormel. Okay. The meat packing plant. And you know what? The town would completely die if that plant was automated. And that kind of relates to, you know, one of the comments that you made about sort of 100% automatable industries. I'm really concerned. I think the nightmare vision that Joshua described is, you know, much more realistic than the more optimistic version.
Josh, can you respond to that?
So my grandfather drove a forklift at the Austin Hormel plant for 30 years and retired from a union position there. So that definitely hits close to home. And yes, I would say in our country, you know, where we have increased the wealth gap over the last 30 years, there really is danger of the haves having everything and the have-nots having nothing. But there are many nations around the world that have built societies that are much more equal, places like Sweden and places like Norway and places like Denmark, Iceland. And I think that we may consider looking at the way that they their tax system functions and the way that they distribute wealth as a model for us.
Well, Joshua Montgomery, thank you for that.
Thank you.
And Ryan Weber, our other local guest with us from the KC Tech Council, thank you.
Thank you.
And Vlad Medenica, thanks for sharing your research from a recent Gen Forward study on what millennials think about the future of work.
Thanks for having me.
In just a minute, we will talk to the editor of KC Hispanic News for an immigration and deportation story you might not have heard. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're checking in regularly on this show with people from community newspapers here in town, people who are immersed in very specific communities and what's happening in them. Today, we're talking with Joe Arce of KC Hispanic News. Hi, Joe.
Greetings. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the mainstream media has been closely following the story of Syed Jamal, but there is another local deportation story that's caught your attention in KC Hispanic News.
Yes, it's the story of a restaurant owner, a lady that has spent about nearly 20 years here in Kansas City, Leticia Sigal Guzman. Do you want me to share a little bit of
yes,
the story?
Yes, please.
Sure. She was deported, and I believe it was in early March, out of her home. She was getting ready to leave to go to the gym. She was apprehended in her driveway and hauled off to jail. And from what I was told by family members, her husband in particular was mentioning to me that what transpired was that she was taken to Platte County Jail, I believe, and held, and then taken to court, and then was transported back. But in the process, some paperwork was delayed somehow, and ICE came in and deported her. And it's really, really difficult once you leave the United States to get to re-enter this country.
So what is it about her story in particular that you think it's important to pay attention to?
Well, for me personally, I feel as though it's history repeating itself. And we saw this back in the 30s here in the United States, where many people were profiled and sent back to Mexico. My mother was one of those individuals. So I sort of have taken taken this personally, because I was about 8 years old myself when I witnessed that my father was no longer with us. And it was just a matter, this was back in the late 50s. And I asked my mother, where's Dad? And she just said, he's on vacation, because she couldn't explain it to me. And so, but later on, I learned that he had been deported. But back in the late 50s, it was just a matter of going back to your home country. My mother was an American, and it took my father about a month and a half to come back. And in today's times, it takes years, the separation of the family. And I was asking my mom where my dad was for 45 days, about 45 days. Every day I would ask, when is he coming back? So it touched my heart a little bit in this particular story, because this particular individual, she goes by Letty. And Letty was, she has a child that's 16 years old. So I can only imagine what she's going through. And after I've spoken to her a couple of times via phone from Mexico. She's in Veracruz, Mexico right now. And she explained to me in detail what happened to her and how this situation happened. And so it's very, very difficult. She's with her mother and her grandmother. And she says, but this is not home. Home is Kansas City.
So it was a child born in the United States, born in Kansas City?
Yes.
So Is there a strong community response to this story?
Absolutely. In fact, we saw that on St. Patrick's Day, there was a, as part of the parade, many immigrants that participated in the St. Patrick's Day parade. And there's so many stories out there where someone is being detained right now, you know, a father, a mother, and those families are being broken up. And so it's, for me, it's very painful to see that. And, you know, another situation that we're not talking much about right now, but at the same time, because this is the focus right now, the deportation with this particular individual, but the DACA students are also facing those situations too. They're safe to stay here, but their parents are not. So we may see that separation also between a DACA student and their parents as well.
So that separation is a sort of theme that you're following and paying attention to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, and you all, believe it or not, I really truly mean this, and that you all have kept up with that, these stories and what's going on in the Latino community, and we appreciate that. But I truly believe that sometimes the mainstream media, they don't cover it enough. If they do it, they say, well, we've already done that story. But at the same time, we're talking about lives here. We're talking about families. We're talking about the separation of families. So to me, it's really, really important that we get that message out there.
You mentioned the St. Patrick's Day Parade. Can you tell me more about the broad immigrant presence in that parade? What were people doing?
Well, you know, the Irish were immigrants. And so, you know, so there was a very diverse parade this year. And Lethe's husband, Steve, was there, and I asked him the question, did you ever think in your wildest dream that you ever would be participating in something like this? And he said, no, never thought in his wild dream. I mean, he runs a business. He's trying to keep the business running, but he found himself, he's doing all this for his wife to help her get back into this country. So he cannot let that story die. Because there's so much support out there, as it was for Mr. Jamal as well. And he's home right now for his family. For how long, we do not know.
You know, something that came up in a recent issue of KC Hispanic News that intrigues me is a bit of a scuffle on the west side having to do with longtime residents of that neighborhood not feeling heard as the city makes development plans for downtown and for that area in particular. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Sure. Years ago, there was a plan for Kansas City's West Side community that the residents and the homeowners there had developed. And then the downtown council also had a plan for the West Side community. And they felt as though the residents felt as though their voices were not being heard. And somehow or other, and the current city council, they cannot tell us what happened, but the downtown council were able to get theirs approved, their plans approved, long-term plans for Kansas City's West Side. And former city councilman Bobby Hernandez and others said, how is it that a downtown council can make decisions for our area? And we had no input, and so they felt as though that they basically, their voices were not being heard. And so they feel as though that this is a very diverse community, a Mexican community, a German community, an Irish community, and they felt as though that this may go away. Because the homes,
the identity, the historic identity of the neighborhood.
Exactly. And I grew up in that neighborhood as well. And so I know where they're coming from. But to be honest with you, it's very difficult for instance, if I wanted to go move back into my community, it would probably take $300,000 to $400,000 to $500,000 for me to move back into my community, because these are the type of homes that are being built in an area that at one time these homes, valued wise, were anywhere between $50,000 to $100,000.
It's that old. Yeah, puts a really sad perspective on that phrase. You can never go home again.
Exactly.
You know, on a more celebratory note, Joe, your paper, KC Hispanic News, just celebrated a milestone: 20 years.
One. 21 already.
21.
Yes.
You can go to the bar.
Absolutely. And they're found in the bar too.
But talk to me, I mean, talk to me about your history with this paper, the journey you've been on.
Well, I'm not sure if you're aware of it or not, but I have a television background. I was at Fox 4 News for 26 years of my first life. And about 3 years when I, well, back in 19, I guess it was 90, about 95, 94, 95, I started giving the idea of when I grow up, what do I want to do? And I kind of did a little soul searching and I said, well, maybe I'll go into real estate or I'll go sell cars or something. Didn't have any background in any of those things. What I had a background was in news, and it was a passion of mine to do more in-depth reporting, and this is what I really wanted to do. I couldn't buy a television station. So I thought, well, next thing I can do maybe is create a newspaper and cover local news. And I remember when I first started, a reporter asked me one time, well, is there enough Hispanic news in Kansas City that you would leave Fox 4 News after a 26-year career and jeopardize all of that to do news in the Hispanic community? And I said, absolutely. There's a lot of news in the community. And so we went from that. I took a huge risk, but it paid off.
Have you ever, I mean, have this is a community that you've said a few times today you grew up in. Have you learned things about that community that you didn't know, that you hadn't understood before by being so immersed in it as a journalist?
I have. I've learned more about, I was born here in Kansas City, but what it has taught me is to learn more about the Mexican community, the Spanish-speaking folks here. I learned a lot from my own home with my mother and my father, but outside of the home, I learned so much. I'll give you an example. When Carlos Murguia, Judge Carlos Murguia, was appointed as a judge, I thought, well, and this is when I was in television, I thought, well, you know, I want to go over and maybe do an interview with Carlos Murguia, and I want to share that story. And so when I got there, it was in the morning. His mother had prepared a breakfast for me. I was not prepared for that. I was prepared to do my job, go in and do an interview and head back to the television station. But I did not accept that breakfast invitation. And to this day—
Because of journalistic ethics?
I think so.
Because you can't take something and then—
Exactly. Yeah. But I regret it.
Why do you regret it?
Because his mother had made fresh tortillas, a pot of beans. You know, these are the things that I grew up with. And, it, you know, and I believe she understood. But at the same time, I felt really bad that I did not accept that. And that's part of the culture. People want to give you something. They want to offer you something, a cup of coffee, a breakfast or whatever. And I tell you, to this day, I do regret it. But if I was in that same situation, to be honest with you, I would go ahead and eat the breakfast.
Well,
because that's the custom.
Tell me more, though, about that first issue. I mean, do you remember it coming off the presses? How you felt?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I do remember that. It was September of 1996, and it was rolling off. I was really, really excited, and I had a great, great staff. And to be honest with you, for the first 6 months, I couldn't pay them. We didn't have any advertising dollars. Unfortunately for me, I was working at Fox 4 News, and I decided to go ahead and leave a year later.
Wow. We'll hear more of that story some other time, I hope. Joe Arce, publisher of KC Hispanic News, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, tune in for a food show. We'll talk about wraps and burritos with the food critics, and we will pop in on an expert tortilla maker to learn some secrets. That's tomorrow at 10. Don't miss it. And Be sure and check out Season 2 of Midwesternish. That's a podcast from KCUR hosted by me for people who heart the heartland. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so stay tuned.